All right, welcome on to a special Supermax contract trade edition of the Hollinger and Duncan NBA show. It seemed like this trade was kind of fait accompli down to what the compensation was going to be, what the protections were going to be. People were kind of debating that before the trade even happened. But John, what were your initial impressions of the John Wall, Russell Westbrook trade?
I was a little surprised that it only took a protected first from Washington in order to pull this trade off. I thought Westbrook had much more left in the tank than John Wall does. We'll see how that plays out over the course of the year. But it was almost the only way out of this situation. As I wrote for The Athletic today, almost the only way this situation could end was with these two guys being traded for each other. There were very few other avenues for these contracts to be swapped just because of their size and their length and the positions of the two players involved. Both teams are at least giving lip service to trying to win this year, but both teams wanted to, or both of these point guards wanted to relocate. So trading them for each other was really the only plausible outcome, to the point that I had people telling me they were sitting around just basically waiting to be traded for each other. So that's where we are. I think it's better for Washington than it is for Houston, but I think both teams are still in a little bit of a pickle regarding their salary caps and their competitiveness and what ultimately happens with their all-star shooting guards. I mean, I don't think this is the move that keeps either James Harden or Bradley Beal in their locations long-term.
Yeah, it's really interesting on the price, right? I thought it was the right price. It was what I was expecting. I think if I were in Washington's standpoint, I wouldn't have wanted to give up anything more than this because it is still an incremental upgrade, as crazy as that is to say, for a guy who was all NBA last year. I didn't think he'd necessarily, well, maybe I did actually have him as all NBA, at least before the bubble happened. Mm-hmm. And he had that awesome streak when he had all that spacing around him, and then certainly the impression that the bubble left was not a good one. But just going back to what they did last year, John Wall didn't play and Russell Westbrook was all NBA and they make the same amount of money. So you'd think that the difference between those two guys is much more than a first round pick. But I think that this trade actually values Westbrook more accurately than might have been expected in comparison to Wall. And I'm not sure how much better it does make Washington, particularly because defense is their biggest problem. I think Westbrook is probably a downgrade there from even, a 70% John Wall, who at least isn't trying to switch every screen because of his bone spurs.
Right.
But I think for Houston, I thought it was actually more of a no-brainer for Houston's standpoint than Washington's because Harden is just going to be leaving, and they know that. I think they're saying all the right things, they're playing it the right way, but once James Harden leaves, Russell Westbrook and John Wall, there's absolutely no difference between those two guys once James Harden leaves, so you might as well just get a first round pick.
I agree with that, sort of. I actually think it's much more plausible to trade Westbrook a year from now than it is to trade John Wall a year from now. So I'm not 100% sure that's true. And certainly Westbrook gives the Wizards a much more viable chance of being, all in for the 8 seed or whatever they want to do this year. So I get back to the protections on the pick where it's top 14, top 12, top 10, top 8, and then it becomes 2 seconds. It doesn't really have any chance of becoming a good pick. And if you look at the Wizards and kind of their history and where they're probably trending in a couple years, you may just be getting 2 seconds out of this. And
Danny and I did discuss that yesterday.
So I have a hard time seeing the upside in this from Houston, other than just you did a Westbrook trade that maybe keeps Harden on board a little longer. I don't know. I mean, this still ends with them trading James Harden. It has to, right?
Well, and that's why I think it's okay. And yeah, I mean, the pick is not amazing, but I'll go back to the point again where I don't think it's really relevant of like, oh, Westbrook would be easier to trade in a year than John Wall. Like, there'd be no need to trade Westbrook in a year because you're not trying to win at that point anyway. Like you're not going to try to open up more salary cap space by moving Russell Westbrook.
Oh, but so you're gonna try to get right down to the salary floor, though, I bet.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you could even imagine John Wall potentially getting bought out at that point for a little bit of a discount. as well. So I think that's the point to me, is just that Westbrook, if he was on this team a year from now, there's no difference between him and John Wall being on this team, because you're not trying to win. The incremental difference between those two guys is limited. To be able to get anything positive for Russell Westbrook at all at any time is worth it, because you know you're in the exact same place whether you have Wall or Westbrook a year from now. So now at least you have a first round pick. And in fact, maybe you're probably better off having Wall, because you can start getting towards the top of the draft again and maybe keep some of these other picks that you owe in the future.
Yeah, that's the really hard part. That's one of the reasons I think they have to look at moving Harden sooner than later, is because the damage from these picks they owe, you know, in the mid to second half of this decade is really going to hammer them if they aren't back into a competitive footing by then. And so, yeah, you know, they have now at least like this heavily protected first from Detroit, heavily protected first from Washington. You know, can they put those into something to get somebody to take Eric Gordon, maybe, or I don't know, put themselves in a position going forward where they just can really do a full teardown and have it done before 2025? Or is it 20? Is it 24? Is it 24 even? I forget when
Okay, so yes,
it starts 2024. Hitting the fan in 24, right?
Yeah, 2024 to OKC top four protected. 2025 swap. Let me just scroll through the four paragraphs I have on this pick on my sheet. I think it's top 10 protected in 2025. The swap, and then 2026 is a straight up first top four protected again. So. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I think do we want to put odds on the chances that neither the Washington nor the Detroit first will convey? It's quite possible, I mean, with those two franchises, isn't it?
Detroit at least has 7 years to get their shit together, right? So there's probably a better chance that conveys at some point, right?
Yeah. Think of it this way. Like,
they can luck into the eighth seed 1 year. Like they did 2 years ago, right? So yeah.
Well, once Servetus comes into his prime, I think they'll be a championship contender. Sorry, I shouldn't have timed that for the podcast listeners. He was just taking a sip of coffee
too early when I said that. Right when I'm sipping my coffee too, he busts that one out. I mean,
we have to do a short segment on the absolute ridiculousness of that. But so, once the Troy Weaver era, I mean, they're going to just get worse over the next 3 years under Troy Weaver, and then he'll get fired, and then they'll still have to build back up. I mean, are they going to make the playoffs by then? I mean, yes, it's more likely than not that in the next 7 years, Detroit will make the playoffs once, but especially with some of those, you know, top 16, top 18. I mean, they have to actually be a decent playoff team in some of these years.
Yeah, or they have to win 37 games in the East, one or the other.
Yeah, I mean, it only goes down to top nine.
Yeah.
The East is better now, though. They're like they've got like eight legitimate potential playoff teams. I guess my question for you is on this Russ Wall thing: how good is Washington now? That's really the question that determines whether this is worth it or not.
Play-in tournament, here we come.
They would have made that anyway, but maybe now they'll even be the eighth seed in the play-in tournament.
I think they probably vaulted ahead of Orlando from 10th into 9th. I think it's probably what they did with this.
I'm not too high on Orlando this year. Let me ask you this, by the way. We haven't really talked about this. Do you think that the play-in tournament is like a good thing for the NBA?
I think it's a good thing from the NBA. I think it would create interest. I think it's more interesting than watching a 1-8 or a 2-7 series in the first round, certainly. I don't like the particular setup of it, because no matter what, you can have a situation where, because there's been years where there's like a 5 or 6 game gap between 8 and 9, or even worse. Like, take the East last year, where there's a giant gulf. And no matter what happens, you know, they say a team would have to win twice to get in or lose twice to be out. You know, if you're a 7-8, you have to lose twice to be out. If you're a 9-10, you have to win twice to get in. But the problem is, you set up a situation where that shitty team that was 9th or 10th only needs to win, no matter who wins that 9-10 game, only has to win once, and they're in the playoffs completely undeservedly, right? Like, oh, well, you won twice. Well, one of them was against another horrible team, so big deal. So I don't like that element of it. I think it's too.
You would have had it be. You would have had it be like, seven, where each of them just has to play the other team, and then like there's
7-10, 8-9, and the lower seed has to win twice. Yeah, I think that's the fair way to do it.
Yeah, I guess it just depends on the year and how far behind the 9th and 10th seed actually is. But if you look at it from the perspective of the 7th and 8th seed, like, you got to win just one out of two games, right? I mean, that's not asking too much, is it?
No. I just, somebody is definitely going to lose the 7-8 game though, right? And somebody will definitely win the 9-10 game. So what you're really saying is that you're bringing it down to there will definitely be a one-game tournament for a team that was in the top eight versus a team that was not.
Yeah, no, that I can understand that aspect, but I do think from the perspective of each individual team, if you're 7-8 and you're like, yeah, we couldn't win one out of these two games. The other thing too that I think would be good is just like it'll give you, I think it's more likely, I think, to give you a better playoffs where, you know, if you just have, let's say 2 years ago where Detroit, Blake Griffin gets hurt right before the end of the year. And yeah, okay, you quote unquote earned that over the course of the year. I don't really care that much about that, frankly. Like, you earned being like at the 45th percentile of your conference if you're the 8th seed. Like, congratulations, right? Like, I would rather actually just see an 8th seed that's playing well at that time. If there's some team that just has an injury and the guy isn't going to play,
you'd rather see last year's Suns make it versus say our 2016 Grizzlies team that had no players.
You didn't even let me get that.
Yeah, I couldn't even let you get your shot in. I know. I was like, I knew exactly where you were going.
Ah, man. So back to the original question, though, of just how good the Wizards are with Russell Westbrook, what his fit is like there.
Yeah, I worry about Beal there. I mean, Scott Brooks is going to indulge Westbrook, I think, and just
yeah, it's a concern.
And is he going to stagger them that much? He's kind of not really been that willing to do that in the past with star players. So Beal, I think, may end up standing around a lot and may get kind of frustrating for him. So I worry about what that means for Beal's longevity there. And I mean, because I still think trading Beal is the best thing for Washington, like I don't necessarily think that's terrible, but if your attitude is we want to stay all in with Bradley Beal and build around him, this is probably not the greatest way to do it, even though on strict value, you won the trade.
Yeah, I mean, Westbrook is more likely to actually be available than John Wall, I think it is fair, although he has his own problems.
Yeah, he might not play back-to-backs again.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And Westbrook's just total inability to shoot versus John Wall just being a bad three-point shooter, but someone who can make an open one. I think that there is an argument to me that John Wall would actually have been better for them than Russell Westbrook, but also seems like the Wall Beal thing had run its course. Ted Leonsis was kind of sick of John Wall as well. Some of the off the court stuff was taking its toll a little bit. But yeah, I am worried that Westbrook will probably shoot too much. John Wall had the ball a lot too, though, back when he was the main guy. I don't know that this makes them. I got to really think about Atlanta a little bit more to see whether they or Atlanta are the favorite for the 8th seed. And our mutual friend Kevin Pelton, I think he agreed with you. He gave them a D because he thinks that they should be trading Bradley Beal. And I mean, shit, they should have traded Bradley Beal in the summer of 2019 when superstars were fetching these massive, massive prices.
They still are, fortunately. I mean, I still think Washington has that window, but the value of him starts going down at the trade deadline. When you start going from a year and a half left on his deal to only a year until the player option, then you really get roped in to only trade him to places where you know he'll re-sign. But on the other hand, I mean, you look, Drew Holiday got multiple unprotected firsts with only a year left.
Yeah, although the Bucks were possibly completely insane to do that. I mean, has there ever been in NBA history a more desperate team than this year's Bucks? Maybe the 2009-10 Cavaliers?
Yeah, 2021 Warriors might be up there.
Oh, man. I am against the trade in the sense that it's like now they're a little more likely to be slightly better and not face reality when it comes to Beal. But when you, I mean, Ted Leonsis is their owner. Like, the front office, as you well know, has to operate within the confines of what the owner wants and attempt to execute his vision. And within those confines, I think this trade probably helps them. It's just that those confines are a little insane, but that's been the case for 2 years.
Well, it's been the case for more than 2 years, right? I mean, the Wizards' whole mentality for the last two decades has been kind of going all in for the eighth seed and not really pushing for anything longer term or more strategic than that.
Masterclass is offering basically their best ever deal here for the holidays. If you're struggling for what to buy someone, highly suggest Masterclass, because if you get yourself an annual membership, you can get one to give to someone else for free. That gives you unlimited access to every Masterclass for you and a friend, loved one, whoever. Right now, you go to masterclass.com/PER. Easy to remember, /PER, because John invented it. Masterclass.com/PER, and you can get that unlimited access for you and someone else for free. This is a great way to take care of your gift giving, because for people who really want to learn more about the world, there's nothing better than Masterclass. Masters in their field, Serena Williams, Stephen Curry, Alice Waters, Chris Voss on negotiation. Go to that masterclass.com/PR link. Check out the over 90 classes now. They continually are adding. My 80 was out of date. Just go and give it a shot. It's all cinema quality. Fantastic, fantastic classes. It's masterclass.com/PR. Once again, masterclass.com/PR. Don't forget that /PR. Let them know that you came from us. I do have one other question I want to ask you about this trade, but let's get a chance to hit up a few questions here first. Let's see if there's anything on this specific topic. Paul George did well with Westbrook, and so did KD, says Pegasus22N.
Yes, that's a fair point. I mean, Paul George did have a really good year in Oklahoma City next to Westbrook. That is true. I mean, KD was a little different because KD actually got left on an island sometimes, and it was just because he was Kevin Durant was so awesome that he was able to overcome that, basically.
Yeah. And that was a Westbrook who, you know, could at least make a 15 footer.
Yeah. That's true. Westbrook was shooting at a higher level then. That probably is the most positive case you can make, that Paul George had a really good year there. Although every other player on the Thunder had their job description as just stand around and watch these two guys. And so it's a little interesting to think what's going to happen with these other players in Washington. You know, they ran a lot of cool stuff for Bertans off the ball. I wonder what's going to happen there, if he's just going to be standing in a corner or not. I don't know.
We'll see whether it
might not be that bad for Beal. I can see that point.
Yeah, and hopefully Brooks will go with the stagger. Maybe he's learned something from the Russ KD days when he always refused to do that. And I mean, if you wanted to pick a team where Westbrook actually fits pretty well, the Wizards are up there with the amount of shooting that they have. They're always going to be all offense anyway. They're always going to try and push the ball hard, which he's good at. He can help them with their rebounding a little bit as well. He also fits right in with their terrible defense.
Yeah, but I was going to say, I mean, the one thing about having Russ there is that Beal might have enough energy to try on defense this year. Because that was the thing that everybody talks about with the offensive year he put up that last year. I mean, he was awful on defense. And I think he has the ability to not be awful, to be clear.
Yeah, so I don't see this really changing the Wizards' fortunes too much this year. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe moves them from 10th to 9th.
Yeah, I mean, I think they just have more certainty of, you know, being in the mix for the 8th seed, whereas I think they had more disaster potential with Wall, because if he wasn't able to play, then they really just didn't have anything at point guard, whereas now with Westbrook, they at least have a little more size and athleticism too. But again, you know, he could fall apart just as easily as Wall could have.
I mean, you're probably looking at 15 games of Ish Smith either way, though, because, I mean, Westbrook wasn't playing back-to-backs last year.
Yeah, and he probably shouldn't this year. So the last topic on this that I wanted to hit, I think this is a good point. Tom Haverstraw tweeted about this yesterday that, you know, these guys are both on Supermax contracts. They got traded for each other. We've seen a lot of guys on Supermaxes get traded now. or I mean, Chris Paul wasn't technically a super max, but he was making the 35% max. And then we've seen a lot of these guys who could have gotten the super max end up requesting trades and going elsewhere and not getting it. Give me a report card for the super max now. They're first eligible to sign these in the summer of 2017. How's this working out for the league?
Well, I think it's had... The idea was that it would keep stars with their teams and help with that. I think it's had some unintended consequences when you look at some of these older stars. Everyone knew the John Wall contract was horrible the day he signed it. Even if he hadn't had the stuff with the Achilles and all that, that was going to be a negative value proposition from the second the ink was dry. What's going to be more interesting, I think, is these contracts like... Westbrook, where you could still argue there was some value there, but probably, you know, the Supermax is such a high number is the problem. And yeah, all these guys decline in their 30s that it really doesn't make sense to pay it. I mean, we're going to see, like, with Lillard's contract, even if he's the best point guard in the league right now, I mean, when that number hits, it's such a high number that is he going to be able to justify that kind of value to be, you know, a $43 million player next season, a $50 million player in 2023-24? Like, you're just getting into numbers that are so high as these players' aging curves are turning the wrong direction. It's just really hard if a guy's not a top five player in the league.
No, absolutely true. And top five players in the league, they have so much leverage and they're so good, they can just go on a year-by-year basis the way we've seen with LeBron and KD. Like, you know, they know that if they get injured, they'll still have a full max contract waiting for them afterwards. So one of two things ends up happening. Either the guys where it really makes the difference for, where it's like, oh my God, this is so much money, I can't pass it up. Those are the guys who, like John Wall, made third team All-NBA 1 year and became eligible for it right then and are never going to make an All-NBA team again. Like, the guys who are like, oh yeah, my career is probably going to be on the downhill, let me grab this money right now. Those are the ones who end up where it ends up actually making the difference for them. And then you also have this situation now where these contracts become such albatrosses that they just and are more likely to end up getting traded later. This idea of, like, we're going to have these guys stay with these teams and then maybe they can retire there. But they're on these terrible contracts because they're making so much, the team is bad, and therefore they end up either wanting out or wanting to get traded, or the team wants to trade them and rebuild, and it doesn't make sense for them to be there anymore. So it really just ends up with these guys like Chris Paul just getting shunted all over the league. Same thing with John Wall, same thing with Westbrook.
Yeah. And it's a way to pay the 12th best player in the league when he's no longer the 12th best player in the league is basically what it is.
Yeah. Well, and then you throw in also the extension aspect of it where, hey, John Wall, you're the 12th best player in the league. Let's start paying you 2 years after you're the 12th best player in the league.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, Wall's case was a little bit separate because, again, everyone knew the second that the ink was dry that was a mistake. It gets more interesting with these guys like Lillard and Westbrook, where they were like more legitimately all NBA players at the time. But you knew that you were paying into a declining market.
Yeah. Now, one thing you can argue is, let's say Dame Lillard, right? He signs this last year. If you didn't have the option to extend him like this, would he have maybe wanted out at some point if things went poorly in Portland? Like, at least by giving him an extra 4 years, you still get the 2 years that you had remaining on his original contract first without feeling like, oh, we got to trade this guy if he's not going to re-sign. The other thing, though, is I think the quote-unquote need for this was more an artifact of the salary cap jumping up to where it just didn't make sense on a normal veteran extension for these guys to come back because their previous salaries were too low to pay them at market rate. Now, though, the regular veteran extension where you can get 3-4 years, like, that's probably good enough for most of these guys.
It's the thing that really makes the Supermax viable from a league-wide perspective is an increasing salary cap environment, and especially if it's increasing by more than 8% per year, which is the maximum raises in a Supermax extension. And so if you're in a situation like we have now where the cap is essentially flat for a couple of years or minimal rises, then these Supermax extensions are just killers.
Yeah. All right, let's hit some more here. Oh, this is a good one from Hot Fudge. Do you see any of these Albatross contracts getting addressed in the new CBA?
I think we got to see what happens in the next couple years with some of these deals. I think it's very possible, depending on what happens with Giannis. I mean, the reason they put this in is so Giannis can stay in Milwaukee and so Anthony Davis can stay in New Orleans, right? So if both of those guys end up turning it down, I think the logical rationale for instituting this in the first place kind of evaporates. So that's going to be a really interesting piece of this. And then we got to see what happens over the next couple years with, you know, with Lillard, with some of these other guys. Steph's going to be eligible for one of these, I think, in the coming year if he makes third team All-NBA. So we'll see what happens with some of these guys over the next 2 years.
Yeah. Well, Steph is already, he's already eligible for 35%. He's just been around. He's been around long enough already. But
Yeah. He has more than 10 years experience. You're right.
He's actually eligible for an extension right now.
Right now. Yeah.
Yeah. We've heard nothing about that.
No. It may be in his interest to do it after the season. But yeah. It's going to be interesting. I do think there's a chance it comes up in the CBA talks. And I think, like, actually, I hate to pin this all on two players, but like it's Giannis and Lillard that I think are really going to determine the league-wide perception of this going forward. If Giannis re-signs in Milwaukee and Lillard retains at least a good chunk of his value over the next couple years and becomes sort of, you know, a franchise icon, all-time leading scorer, you know, part of the furniture there no matter what, and has like a Dirk send-off at the end, then I think people feel much more positively about the Supermax. Whereas if Giannis doesn't sign and Lillard turns into, you know, 4 years and $200 million of not much at the tail end of this, then I think there's a very different perception of the Supermax.
How is from a Mully 43? Why did AD sign a 4+1 with an ETO versus the 2+1 when he could have gotten that 10-year max after that?
I think he's thinking about the deal after that. I think he's thinking that if he does a 2+1 and then signs a 5-year max right away, he might actually end up with less overall earnings over the course of, say, the next decade than if he does a 4+1, opts out after 4 when he's 31 and jumps in for that last big bag at 31. My guess is that was what he was thinking. He was thinking about the overall picture of the 9 to 10 years. Because if you look at the next couple years of the cap, the 8% rises in his extension are going to outrun the increases in the salary cap. Not enough to offset the difference between 35% and 30% between 22 and 24. But if there's a big cap jump from 22 to 24, he can actually make up some of that difference. My estimate is about $8 million on the second deal. And then he can go out more years if he's signing a 5-year deal at 31. So I think he's looking at the bigger picture of that. That would be my guess, because otherwise you're right. Yeah. The 2+1 in very narrow, just over the next 5 years, he could earn more money.
Also, I believe the new TV contract will kick in for the 24-25 season, and perhaps that will lead to a salary cap jump. That could be part of this.
Especially once he gets that Twitch money.
The thing that I didn't understand was why the ETO instead of the player option, because once you exercise an early termination option, I mean, basically for this is quite arcane, but the ETO essentially means the default is that you're opted in, and then to opt out, you send in the paperwork. The player option is the default is you're opted out, and then you send in the paperwork. But a vestige from previous CBAs when you could have ETOs earlier than the last year of your contract, if you exercise an ETO, you then cannot extend that contract, whereas a player option, if you decline it, then you can still extend. That's what LeBron James just did right now. So I'm curious. I mean, now, one nice thing is that if you get traded, your trade bonus applies to the ETO year. It doesn't apply to the player option year. But I would think you would rather want to keep your extension options open rather than worrying about the trade bonus.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, because there's one arcane thing in there, because we had to do...
Yeah, you guys did an ETO with Mike Conley.
We had to do an ETO with Mike Conley, and I can't remember why, but it had to be an ETO and not a player option. And I can't remember if they changed the rule also between when we did that and now. But
yeah, because that would have been the previous CBA. I don't think they changed anything about ETOs in the new CBA.
There was a reason in that deal that it had to be an ETO, and it may have been because it had partial protect. Oh, I know. It was partially protected on the last year, and otherwise the option year would have had to match the year before. So I think that's why we had to do an ETO, which I'm guessing Davis's deal is fully protected, so that's probably not an issue. But there may be some other arcane piece of it that required it to be an ETO.
Yeah, I can't think of what that would be. However, you've all heard me talk about Theragun before, and there's no reason not to try it. A, because it's the holidays, but B, because you can try it for 30 days risk-free. It is basically the best way to take care of your body. If you have muscle soreness, if you just have that one spot that you just can't get a knot out of, you have adhesions all over your body, you just have been sitting for 3 hours recording a podcast and you get up and your hips feel really stiff, Theragun can help you a ton with all that. It can get you back to doing the activities that you want, feeling better. If you have some neck pain, some back pain, even if I'm getting a headache, I can a lot of times trace that back to my upper back and my neck, and I can relieve some tension with the Theragun. It just works so well. It is the best body maintenance tool I am aware of, and you can try it now for 30 days. Their Theragun Gen 4 has an OLED screen, personalized app, and the quiet and power that you need. It starts only $199. Go to Theragun.com/PER right now and get your Gen 4 Theragun today. That's Theragun.com/PER. Easy to remember because John invented it. Theragun.com/PER. Don't forget that /PER to let them know that you came from us. Okay, let's move on here. And I sent you last night my off-season grades that for the podcast that Danny and I did on Dunked On Prime last week. You are going to take a look at them and tell me which ones you disagree with. So go ahead, lay it on me.
All right. This is hard because I agree with a lot of what you got here. I think the F for Detroit was too high.
Too high? Yeah. like too good.
Yeah, I would have given it an F minus. So
yeah, well, in my defense, I didn't know about the Servetus move yet at that point.
You know, Milwaukee's an interesting one because you gave him a D, and for the most part, I agree. Like, I think it generally was bad. You know, kind of they completely botched the whole Bogdanovich thing. They botched the Connaughton thing. They probably overpaid for Holiday. But at the end of the day, the number one thing they could have done to improve their team was getting Jrue Holiday. Like, he was the most attainable player for them that would increase their odds of winning a championship the most. And they did acquire him. So it's tough for me to give them a D because of that, because you do want to maximize your Giannis window, right? So yeah. I can be a little more partial than that. And maybe say that was like a, I can't quite go D for them on that. Like, I'm thinking more C plus kind of, you know,
Well, here, are you done on Milwaukee? I wanted to respond to that.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Before we move on to another team. So, I mean, from a process standpoint, they deserved a Q.
Well, except no, they targeted Holiday and Bogdanovich, right? That was a good start of the process. Everything else wasn't so great.
Yeah, well, and I mean, to screw up Bogdanovich, I mean, my best reading based on all the reporting has been that they made the deal with Bogdanovich, then they made the Holiday trade, and they either knew that they would have to back out of the deal with Bogdanovich and offer him less, or that they just didn't realize the Holiday unlikely bonus hard cap issue, which they would have to deal with the Bogdanovich sign and trade, where Holiday basically against the hard cap gives you like $3.5 million in dead money, and then they couldn't pay Bogdanovich as much. So one of those two things was just a massive, massive screw up. I don't know, maybe Giannis, due to his relationship with Bogdanovich, it was more important for him to get Bogdanovich than Holiday. And then, so that might be part of it. this is so risky to basically give up four unprotected picks when you don't know if Giannis and Jrue Holiday are sticking around, or if they made the deal based on Bogdanović also coming and thinking that Giannis would re-sign based on that, and now he's not going to re-sign. Maybe he will, and it won't be as bad, but you're still going out so far into the future with those picks where Giannis could be gone. So I do see the point of, hey, if they win the championship this year, and it's because they got Jrue Holiday, and Jrue Holiday was unbelievable, then yeah. I also don't think Jrue is like such an amazing fit. Like, all right, do you think they're the championship favorites now that they got Jrue Holiday?
I think they're the Eastern Conference favorites.
Yeah, I mean, their depth is so bad, though.
Yeah,
I mean, I know exactly. It doesn't
matter. They're not
going
to rack up as many regular season wins, but the five-man unit they could put on the floor at the end of the games is significantly better than what they could do last year, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little worried about, like, Wes Matthews, I think, was still important for them to be able to guard some of these big wings. Like, Drew's a little short for that. They're still relying on DiVincenzo at the two. They have zero flexibility against the hard cap. They had to punt two roster spots on the 45th and the 60th pick with the hard cap. So I don't even know how active they can be in the buyout market. They still hard cap themselves because they got Bobby Portis. Like, they could have done everything else that they wanted to do and not been hard capped if they had just not given Bobby Portis the BAE, basically.
Well, I mean, Augustin's deal was for too much, though.
Well, no, they could have done the same thing you were talking about them doing with George Hill last year, where they just put a little more guarantee on the third year of the mini mid level and given him the same guaranteed money over 2 years.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because he's a partial on the third year right now, so they could have done a lower first year guarantee and a larger partial on the third year. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so just. Yeah, I think they could upgrade if they still had the ability to upgrade their roster at all during the season. If the cupboard weren't just so dry, I would feel much better about this. But yeah, I mean, we'll see. If they win a championship and Giannis resigns, all good. You know, this moves up to probably a B in retrospect a year from now. Or it could be the absolute worst offseason in NBA history. Like, there's a lot of variability
here. It's catastrophic if Giannis leaves. You have to know Giannis is re-signing to go ahead with the Holiday deal. I agree with you on that. So if he doesn't, that's a problem.
Can
we talk about two teams in the West?
Oh, big time. Let's go.
There are two of these that I violently disagree with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Utah gave them a B. Utah, you gave them a B. I thought they had a terrible offseason. I thought they had a real window to be next year's Miami. And they screwed that up. And they also screwed up their future with the Mitchell extension. So in the short term, their window to being sort of the next Miami was to find, if they weren't happy with Tony Bradley, find a cheap backup five, whatever, to play the 8 minutes Rudy Gobert isn't in a big game. And then get yourself a real backup 3-4 with your mid-level exception so that you have actual wing depth, actual size at the 3-4, and multiple players you can use in those roles, and you're not depending on 20 minutes of George Niang in your most important game in the season. Instead, they go full mid-level on Derek Favors. Like, you already had him. You know this doesn't work. You can't play him and Gobert in a playoff game. This is a known, right? Like, what are you doing? If you're going to get the band back together, do it on Jay Crowder, who got the same money. Getting Favors was, and he's not a terrible player, but the fit-wise, this was just insane. And then they drafted a giant center in the first round, too, and gave up a second to get rid of their other giant center, Tony Bradley. So they spent all their offseason energy on kind of the least important thing. And then the second half of that was Mitchell's extension was just a capitulation. I mean, they just basically handed him a blank sheet and said, fill it in however you want. He gets 30% max, even if he's third team all NBA. He has the player option on the fifth year, which in a small market, that's the thing you have to hold the line on, especially when you're not dealing with like a LeBron level talent, right? It's Donovan Mitchell. He's good, but like there are tiers to this cake, right? And I just don't think that you had to cave that way. And I think we saw with some of the other extensions, you know, the ones that Bam Adebayo or De'Aaron Fox signed, that teams don't necessarily have to do that. And I don't understand why Utah did that either. And I feel like between those two things, they, one, wasted a chance to be a real potential surprise team this year. And two, really started the clock on on whatever is next for Mitchell potentially, because once you do that player option, you know, the clock really starts 2 years out from that player option year, which isn't that far away anymore. So all of a sudden, if you're looking at a situation where Gobert leaves and, you know, a couple of these other guys age out, then Mitchell's sitting there looking around and like, well, I don't know if I want to be here anymore either.
So I agree with you on the Mitchell thing. That was terrible. Now, the rest of it, though, this was my list of players at the three who I think could fill the type of role you were talking about to be the next Miami. You had Jay Crowder. Okay, yeah, he went to Phoenix for the same money. Like, Jay Crowder didn't play that well in Utah. I don't know that they necessarily wanted to have him back. They gave him away in a salary dump to Memphis.
He was in the Conley trade, yeah.
Last year. So, and, you know, they maybe could have made that be Dante Exum instead, although maybe Memphis didn't want Dante Exum. But still, I think, I don't know that they felt like he was going to be that great. Jay Crowder is also going to play a larger role in Phoenix. That's true. A pandemic year where it'd be nice to be able to like go outside and like be social with people instead of being in Utah where it's cold. And Phoenix is just, I think now has always been a good market. And now that Chris Paul is there, they're actually becoming a free agent destination again. I just don't think that player was available. Sure, I would love to get cheap backup center, although they did try the cheap backup center route last year and they ended up without somebody who could play in the playoffs. I think Favors was probably just the best player that they could get for the mid-level. And I just don't know who, I mean, Derek Jones Jr., did he want to go there? Like, he's starting in Portland. Like, they can't offer a starting role to these guys the way some of these other places go. I mean, should they have gone with Glenn Robinson III? Maybe, although they probably could have got him anyway.
It's amazing how many of these guys Utah cycled through already. I'm looking, it's like, oh, Rodney Hood, Alec Burks, like Jay Crowder. <Yeah. laughs> It's a pie on to former Jazz backup wings, kind of.
What I take issue with is this idea that there really was some other alternate path. I don't believe that there was. And then to be willing to like pay the tax for a team that's pretty good, you know, like I think you deserve credit for that.
They're not going to pay the tax.
Who are they moving to not pay?
What do you mean? They're a million over. All they got to do is trade one or two of these non-guaranteed contracts right before the guarantee date with cash, and then, you know, do the 10-day dance, keep their roster at 14. They'll end up like $12 below the tax at the end of the year.
Yeah, okay, you're right. They were not as far in it as I thought. Okay, I apologize for that. But, I mean, they're still pretty expensive. And, you know, maybe they'll add salary if they make a trade during the season. Like, that's a possibility. We'll see. But
the other thing they could have done, speaking of moves, is traded for Robert Covington, right?
Where do they have two first-round picks laying around?
Well, they had one this year, right? I mean, yeah, although, Ed Davis and Tony Bradley is your salary match, right?
Right, but remember, so like that was the 16th pick that Portland gave up. Utah had 27 this year, so that's a big difference already. And then they still owe Memphis one from the Conley deal. And this is also a team that has a lot of expensive guys. Like, if you're going to have Gobert and Mitchell, I mean, those picks are gold. You got to fill in more guys around them. The other reason I like Favors is it gives them some insurance to still be competitive next year if Gobert leaves or if he just has to be traded and they can't come up with an extension for him.
I agree with that. I mean, so the one thing I'll say in their favor, and I remind people of this when they're evaluating off seasons, that playoff rosters still aren't due for a while. So that teams do have the capacity to do in-season work. Maybe they're able to do a trade with Favors in season where they bring back somebody who can play who's, you know, a more like 6'8", 6'7", switchable guy that fits, that isn't available right now. Or, you know, maybe they're able to do something with, I don't know, Royce O'Neal or something and bring in another guy like that. So that those options are still out there. Maybe there's a Gobert deal that brings them back a big time player at the 3-4, and then they just move Favors into the starting lineup. So there are still roads here and possibilities.
I could be talked into you saying it's like a C or a C plus.
Yeah.
But I think they got two good players, one of whom was Clarkson to come back. And you know, they got one of the best players available at the mid level. They got a starting level of player to come in. I mean, I think they just want to play Gobert less during this year as well. They want to not have to play Gobert for 43 minutes a game during the playoffs. That might be nice to be able to play. He's a big guy to play him 37 minutes. You know, that would be nice too. So I mean, I do understand the feeling of like, hey, Rudy Gobert's going to play a lot of minutes. Like, why use your mid level on favors? It's just, I just don't see who else was out there. Like, if you just look at who the best actual player was that they could have gotten in Utah for a guy who, when you don't have a starting position to offer, I think they did pretty well. The improved Built Bar is even more delicious. They have 18 amazing flavors now. It's just the best tasting protein bar out there. Cookies and cream, cherry barcia, apple almond crisp, lemon almond cheesecake. Those are some of the new ones. Then there's classics like raspberry, German chocolate, peanut butter brownie, double chocolate. If you like chocolate and you like peanut butter, this is definitely the protein bar for you. The bars are covered in 100% chocolate. They are soft and easy to chew, but yet still 19 grams of protein, 180 calories, 5 grams of sugar, 5 grams of net carbs in, for example, that peanut butter flavor. So they're low calorie, low sugar, high protein, high fiber, great for a keto diet. And you can even get a free cooler with purchase while supplies last. Go to builtbar.com, use the promo code LOCKEDON, the name of this network. You get 20% off your next order. Use promo code LOCKEDON for 20% off at builtbar.com. All right. What's your next disagreement?
I disagree with you on Minnesota.
Okay, you thought they were better or worse than I had. What did I have for them? I had something pretty terrible, I think. Right?
Yeah. I actually kind of like their offseason. You gave them an F+, which I pretty violently disagree with. Getting Ricky Rubio for James Johnson, like, I'm sorry, that is a win, okay? That is a major win.
I disagree with you because Ricky Rubio also goes out another year and he's not going to start for you. Like, does this team that has nothing at the 3 and 4, you want to talk about like the opportunity cost with favors, they're going to pay $17.8 million next year for a backup guard?
It's an expensive luxury. I agree with that.
Right. I mean, okay, yeah, if it's just swapping Rubio for James Johnson for this year, sure, go for it. I agree. That helps. But then, I mean, I think those guys are like somewhat similar assets, at least as the Wolves are concerned, because remember, they got like Sacred Cow D'Angelo Russell. Also, I think you're putting the cart before the horse here. Like, they took the wrong guy at number one. They clearly took the wrong guy at number one.
You think they should have taken LaMelo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they didn't because they tripled down on the Sacred Cow D'Angelo Russell, who I think you and I both agree is just not worthy of affecting your decisions as a franchise to this degree. And particularly when, okay, we can't have another point guard in here, but then now we're going to spend $17 million on another point guard instead, when it doesn't add up to me at all. And okay, it really just seems like so much of this was based on catering to D'Angelo Russell's ego. And I think LaMelo has a good chance to be better than Russell. I don't know if his median outcome is higher, but I think his upside is way higher than Russell. Yeah, and by the way, you don't have to pay him the max.
Yeah, and that's really what you're shooting for in a rebuild like Minnesota, right? The problem is, I mean, they have no viable alternative other than plowing ahead with Russell at this point, right? Yeah.
Where are they going with this group? Like, maybe this could be a 7th seed one day?
No, I'm sorry. The other thing, viable option that's still out there is they could trade Russell for John Wall.
Yeah. Now, I mean, and I did say this at the time. If Anthony Edwards works out, and I'm wrong about him, this grade shoots way up. Because he is the better fit. He does have the upside. I just thought LaMelo is going to be a much better player than him, or at least has a much higher upside than him. So if I'm wrong on that, then I disagree. But I mean, I got to go with my evaluation here. And I thought that was kind of your evaluation too.
No, I mean, I'd be more like C-. There were other elements of this I didn't like. Giving up a second to lock in Ed Davis as your backup center, like, just get somebody for the minimum. Like, it's not any different.
Or wait until New York waives him.
Well, there's that too. Yes. Although, I mean, they gave it up partly to get off of money too. But the financial end game would have been very similar. You're right. If you just wait till New York likely cuts him. The Beasley extension was on the high side, certainly. I thought Wancho's was more fair. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson on a non-guaranteed minimum. Yeah, I don't know how he slipped.
In fairness, I that had not come down when I left the grid. Yeah. That might have bumped him up to an F++.
Hollis Jefferson on a non-guaranteed minimum was an absolute steal. I think he may end up starting for them, actually. I thought that was one of the best value deals, and I don't really know how he slipped through the cracks so much. I mean, I know he's a weird player and whatnot, but like he's effective. But like bigger picture here, I understand there's a sense of like, where are we going? Like we're just all in on Russell and Towns, you know, we're locked into like, you know, Jarrett Culver, can he play? Like, is he any good? And we're just kind of locked into past decisions and in a way that's not super encouraging. And yet, like, when I run the numbers on this team, they might not be that bad. Like, there's actually the kernel of, like, a decent team here, believe it or not.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of like Wizards West right now.
Yes. Yeah, with the overpaid point guard and, oh, man, that's a good one. Yeah, that is kind of what they are.
Yeah, I mean, and they might even have a better offense than them. I mean, Karl Anthony Towns is an absolutely awesome offensive player. I think that's been lost a little bit. Yeah. I mean, he was playing at a crazy high level the first month of the season before he got hurt last year. Absolutely. All right, let's hit some more. Did you have any more disagreements? First of all, that we could probably.
I think I'm basically on board with everything else.
Yeah.
As I scan through this, I'm trying to think if there's one that really got me fired up, and I didn't really see anything.
Did I convince you at all on Minnesota? Or are you sticking with your C minus?
I think it's more like a C minus. There are a few things here that were actually pretty okay, I thought, even though some of it was bad.
Okay. Let's see here. Hit some questions real quick. See some of the people who highlighted their messages. Top her four. Can you rate the Sixers off season this year compared to last year's? Are they a better team now compared to last season?
They are a better team with emphasis on the word team. I think these pieces fit much more capably, and it's an opportunity now to really see what Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid are, because the guys around them are now set up in a way to optimize whatever it is Simmons and Embiid can be. And we don't know the total answer to that question, and I think that's what we're going to find out this year, is what is the ceiling for a Simmons and Embiid team if they have reasonably good role players around them who can make shots and do role player things and not get in each other's way. So I think we're going to learn the answer to that this year.
Another question asking who the top buyout candidates are this year. This is always interesting, right? Because it's guys who in theory can still play, but also don't have enough value on their contracts to be tradable for value. As I scan the list here, it doesn't look like there are that many of these guys. Cody Zeller might be one.
That play-in game is going to hurt the buyout market.
Yeah.
Because you think about it, I mean, Charlotte's going to be trying to get into that game, right? For as long as they can. So, like, you got to be out of 10th before the buyout thing really becomes prominent for you.
Yeah, and also just the shorter season as well. There's just less time for teams to fall out of it.
Gorgui Dieng, I think, will be a name on the buyout market.
Yeah, assuming that Memphis has a rough year, which with the news that Winslow and Jaren Jackson won't be starting the season is looking more likely now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, depending on how they use Clark and Jackson in the second half of the season, if his minutes get squeezed enough and they want to get like Jontae Porter and Xavier Tillman out there, I could see Memphis just giving him his wings, even if they're in like contention for 10th or 9th or whatever. Julius Randle, maybe?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, at only 26, he does have $4 million guaranteed for next year. But yeah, he really doesn't seem to fit in New York's plans.
But he's a Kentucky guy, though, so possibly not. Reggie Bullock could be another one.
Yeah, he's one where I think you could probably get a second for him in a trade if he's going to be playing.
Yeah, the Oklahoma City Thunder roster.
Well, I mean, I think those guys, they'll be trying to trade them as expiring contracts for guys who are bad contracts going forward and hoping to pick up an asset that way. But I don't know if they can do that with the entire roster.
Yeah, I think it's going to be hard with like Trevor Ariza and Justin Jackson. Like, I think those two guys have a decent chance ending up as buyouts. George Hill and Al Horford, I presume, get traded at some point.
JaVale McGee on Cleveland, I think, is someone might be kind of a lower level of guy there. Maybe Nemanja Bjelica.
I think he's too good to be a buyout guy. I think he's a trade guy.
Yeah, you might be right about that.
Jabari Parker.
Yeah, no, he was right next on my list there for sure. Yeah, someone said Otto Porter. I don't think so. I mean, maybe just because he makes so much that he can't be traded. I just have no idea what's going to happen with the Bulls here. And
they're a hard one to read right now.
Yeah.
I think Felicio will be available in the buyout market.
As soon as tomorrow, potentially.
Yes.
I think Tony Snell, maybe possibly at the Hawks, if he just ends up
not playing, which might be a thing. Yeah, I could see them, like Travis's history, he's pretty accommodating with situations like that. I could see him letting Tony Snell get out if he just says, you know what, I'm not playing, I'd really rather be someplace else.
Two more, Patty Mills and Rudy Gay.
Yes. Clearly San Antonio is going to try to trade those four guys if they have any common sense at all this season. When you look at LaMarcus Aldridge, DeMar DeRozan, Patty Mills, and Rudy Gay, I don't know if they're going to go 4 for 4 though. And whoever's left will be a buyout candidate for sure.
Yeah. The commenter suggested Thaddeus Young as well.
Yeah. Although there's money on that third year, which could complicate things. The San Antonio, the other thing is if they don't make a trade, they definitely are going to want to buy out at least one of these guys because they're 1.5 over the tax rate. I mean, I guess they'll get under if they cut Zeller, but they're close enough to the tax that this could matter.
Yeah, the Bulls, though, I think what you're saying about the play-in is a good point where I'm not sure that guys will get bought out. The Bulls would be a pretty disastrous season for them to not even be in the mix for the 10th seed.
They should. I think they'll be in the mix for the 10th seed at least for a while, hopefully. I mean, yeah.
But by the way, I mean, this play-in game is just manna from heaven for like any embattled coach or GM to be able to spin it to where, oh, you know, we're still in contention, like to now, oh, we're just, you know, two games out of making the play-in, like we're so close.
Yeah, totally. You'll definitely see that. Some of these Western teams, especially where you actually have to be legitimately decent just to get in the play-in, I think it's going to give some oxygen to some of these situations that maybe would look pretty desperate otherwise.
Okay, let's get into our next topic here. Who are the really elite teams? We can kind of go through it in tiers here. Who are your tier one teams for this year?
Okay, so tier one for me, I don't know how many regular season games they will win, but the Lakers are clearly tier one, right? They're the defending champions. How can you not have them in tier one, right?
Yeah, let's move on. They're obviously in there.
Okay. The next two teams are teams that had crushing disappointments in the playoffs last year, but clearly have loaded rosters. Milwaukee and the Clippers. I think they have to be in tier one. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. It's actually pretty remarkable. I would say that this season, if you want to just say, you know, predict like in the regular season, who's going to be a dominant team? Like, I don't see that team out there. It's been a long time, I think, since we've been able to say that at the start of a season where you just don't, like, if we were doing full season here, I don't think I would predict any team to win 60 games this year.
I have even in a 72 game season, I have every single team projected to lose at least 20 games.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd agree with you on that.
But, yeah, I mean, I think you do have to put Milwaukee and the Clippers in there. But I could see either of those teams, Milwaukee actually more likely than the Clippers, kind of just falling out of it. And we'll see. I the Giannis situation still, if he doesn't sign, I mean, man, like that pressure, I usually kind of eschew this discussion of, oh, they're under such pressure, like these kind of external factors. But that's one where I might make an exception. I mean, that would
it's LeBron's last year in Cleveland all over again.
Even worse, because at that point, I don't know how many people really seriously thought he was going to leave Cleveland. You know, having just won his first MVP, they won 66 games the year before. And, you know, now it's just a much different culture in terms of changing teams now, in part because of what LeBron did, than it was 10 years ago. Like, you didn't, like, Shaq was really the only guy who was like a mega, mega star who moved in free agency before LeBron that I can recall.
Tony Allen. You know, the Clippers are facing the same thing, though. You know, you think Kawhi wants to be in L.A. and Paul George wants to be in L.A., but they can opt out after the season, too.
Yeah, well, you know, now that Paul George isn't going to be used like Ray Allen, I'm sure everything will be fine there. He's not going to have any complaints this year.
Yeah, no, that's good, because I remember all those times Ray Allen hit the side of the backboard on consecutive possessions with open corner threes.
Was it two possessions in a row? I thought it was.
I can't remember if it was consecutive possessions. It was definitely consecutive shots, though.
They had a few bad misses in that game seven. I think we can say that. So is Milwaukee, Clippers, LA? I mean, those were the favorites coming into the bubble last year. Clearly, that was tier one last year. Is that the sum total of your tier one this year?
That is my tier one. Yes.
Why are the Miami Heat not in that? They just made the finals and they got pretty much their whole team back.
I still think there was a lightning in a bottle aspect to that. I'm very comfortable with them in tier two, but they were outscored over six games by Boston. They weren't a dominant regular season team at all. I just have a hard time saying it's like automatic that they're this elite team now.
Yeah, I don't think. I thought that like a lot of guys played way better in the bubble than the regular season. Butler, Dragic, I think the bubble was Crowder. Very well
what
set up.
What about Crowder, who's gone now and replaced by Harkless?
Yeah, no, that's a great point as well. You know, Andre Iguodala is a year older. He didn't look too great last year. Now, you might say, yeah, we got Bam Adebayo, Tyler Hero, and Duncan Robinson, and Kendrick Nunn, and those guys are all young enough that, yeah, if there's a little drop-off from the vets, those guys can make it up. But I do think, like, the bubble just seems so uniquely suited for guys like Butler and Dragic, where they didn't have a whole regular season behind them. They could just come in, they're in great shape because they're on the Heat, and the Heat, you know, just from a mental standpoint, they were able to deal well with the bubble. That's what some people are saying. So I'm not writing the Heat off, but I it's just hard to know what to take from the bubble, right? Like, I mean, you said it, the Lakers, or I think it was DA who said this actually, that the Lakers are sort of pretending that a lot of the stuff that happened in the bubble didn't exist with their offseason moves, which maybe is a smart move. So yeah, I would probably have Miami down a little bit lower in terms of contenders. And then also when you consider that they're not going to make any moves to take on any money beyond the summer of 2021, that kind of limits their improvement options during the season. So
yeah, we'll see. I mean, I do think they're still positioned to do some stuff in season. And especially the odd thing is that if Giannis signs that extension, it liberates Miami to make other moves in season that they might not have done otherwise that then could push them into that upper tier this season.
Yeah, there was a report from Barry Jackson that they're going to try and go after Bradley Beal. That's looking a little less likely now. Boston, I mean, I think they pretty unequivocally got worse. They also have this $27 million trade exception, though, and they do have some young guys, and they've got all their first-round picks going forward and a bunch of seconds. So that's one where they could get a lot better. And then also just the young guys improving. The Kemba news is rather disheartening for them, though.
That's disturbing. And then the other thing, I thought Boston really screwed up by using its mid-level exception on another center who isn't that different from the two they already have, rather than getting another player who can back up at the 3-4.
Who is that guy?
Bring back Jay Crowder. But yeah, I know. I'm a broken record here. But their depth, and especially knowing Kemba would be down, that they could have gone maybe into the point guard market too. Instead of, like, they're looking at, you know, Peyton Pritchard and Jeff Teague. I think they were irrationally excited about Jeff Teague based on what I saw from him in Atlanta last year. He's a minimum guy now.
He can't play in the playoffs anyway. I mean, it's good to have another ball handler, but I mean, Wanamaker to me is better than him in the playoffs. Just letting him go, it seemed like an own goal to me. They had restricted rights on it. I don't understand why they did that, but
yeah.
What about the Brooklyn Nets?
So I think they have to be in tier two because even though I think their median outcome maybe isn't that great, they have a wide variance. And the upside of that variance is pretty damn high. We just don't know what Kevin Durant's going to be this year coming off the Achilles. And if he's still awesome, then I think Brooklyn is in pretty good shape to be potentially kind of the number two team in the East. And if not, then I think they have some problems. But they also are pretty well situated for trades, too. If you look at, you know, you have a Jared Allen, you have a Spencer Dinwiddie that you can throw into deals. They still have kept their powder pretty dry on the draft pick front. So they're in good shape on doing some stuff in season. as well. So I think they have some interesting possibilities, even though, again, I think their median outcome is probably more likely they're in the 4-5 game in the East. But there's a high side to these guys that you can't ignore.
No, I agree with you. And it's, it really is. Looking at these East teams, like, those top six could finish in nearly any order to me. I mean, the Sixers, I think, are going to be a lot better this year.
I think Philly's going to be a lot better, definitely. Yeah, I'm excited to see what they can do. I'm still not sure it's like a great team, but I'm interested to see what it is.
And then Toronto, you know, I didn't think they had the playoff upside to begin with, and then losing both Gasol and Ibaka. Maybe that doesn't hurt them as much for the regular season. They can get by with Baines and Len and Boucher. But I just think in the playoffs, it's going to be tough for me to see how they get past the second round.
They're like a generic milquetoast playoff team now, I think is what they are.
Yeah, although I still think they're going to be good in the regular season. Like, I do not count them out in the slightest as a regular season team. And Kyle Lowry is going to have a decline someday, right?
You would think so, although maybe not in his walk year.
Yeah, it's tough when you're, I think he's 34 now, which is, that's getting up there for a small guard. So what about in the West? Who do you have as third in the West right now?
So Dallas is the team that I've really circled as a tier two team this year. I think they could be really good. The health questions around Porzingis are probably the biggest issue, and what he can be when healthy and how much he will be healthy, right? But you have the fact that you're definitely going to have like a top four player in the league this year, right, with Luka. I think the Curry-Richardson trade will help them because it gives them a legitimate wing defender, which they didn't really have last year. I think they took another couple of shots at that type of player with these deals for Awundu and drafting Josh Green. I mean, they're trying to address that flaw. And then, you know, we'll see what happens with Dwight Powell and what kind of condition he comes back in. But they have some backup at these spots. When you look at Kleba and Cauley-Stein, like, they're a deep team. They get Jalen Brunson back this year. Trey Burke, I thought, was a good deal. Like, they got a lot of stuff, even when Luka's off the floor. So I think that'll really be a wind at their back in the regular season. And I think they have a shot to get a top two seed, honestly.
Yeah, I'm a little less sanguine about that just due to the Porzingis issue. But we'll see what Powell can give them and Cauley-Stein can give them as well. And I don't know how much they're going to want to play Luka again. I mean, this regular season, I can never remember when there's been this crazy of a prediction market for a season. I just have no idea what's going to happen with all the injuries and guys coming back from injuries and the fact that there's 72 games in, you know, 3.5 months or whatever it's going to be. And I guess four and a half months. I just have no idea. I feel like I can predict the playoffs a little bit better, but, you know, I mean, Golden State is another one, right? What do you make of the Warriors sans Klay Thompson this year?
I am worried about them. I think they're going to have a hard time being more than an average team.
So 36 wins.
Maybe not even 36.
Oh, baby.
Like, I mean, Curry's still an all-star player, clearly. This Draymond's, you know, he's probably got something left, right? Probably more than he showed a year ago. But then, you know, you get to like Oubre, Wiggins, like, I mean, Kelly Oubre's fine, but like, if he's your third best player, like, how good are you? I don't think the bench is that good. I think certainly
I disagree with you on that. I think the bench is actually pretty good, but we'll see. I mean, some of these young guys will have to come through, but I mean, you know, if Steph Curry is 95% of what he was in 2019, then I think these guys are still pretty good. I mean, I'm just a little worried about their shooting and creation outside of Curry. I think they could be decent defensively. But to me, it all just comes down to what you get from Curry and Draymond. Another one of these, who the hell knows? Those guys basically both missed the entire season last year.
Yeah, although, I mean, you remember, they were getting their asses kicked before Curry got hurt.
Yeah, but they also had D'Angelo Russell, and I think they just knew that they were going to be terrible. And they would have figured it out to some degree, I think, with those guys. But you know, they would have figured it out with Steph. So, anyone else in the West that really? I mean, you have the Mavs as the third best playoff team. I think I probably would agree with you there as long as Porzingis is healthy. I mean, I could even say, I mean, the Suns and the Blazers Like, I could see...
So I have, like, Denver and Portland lurking, right?
Yeah. I could see, like, any of, like, six or seven teams being the number one seed this year in the West.
Really?
Just because I don't think the Lakers and the Clippers are really going to try that hard. The Lakers, to me, clearly will be the best team. And maybe having Harrell and Schroeder will help them more in the regular season, potentially.
I'm totally expecting Cleveland era LeBron regular season from the Lakers this year. I can't argue with you in that. Like, I'd kind of be surprised if they had the best record in the West again. I just don't think there's a lot of incentive for them to play for that. Just they'll win exactly enough games to get a halfway decent seed and then deal with everything else from there.
Well, so here's why I think that it could be one of any of these teams. If you're saying that, you know, we're talking about a 55-56 win type of team under normal circumstances getting the number one seed, like there's always a couple teams that just pop to that level every year that you just don't necessarily anticipate. So, like, can I construct a scenario where the Phoenix Suns get into, like, you know, winning 53-54 games in a normal season? Yeah, I could absolutely construct that scenario. I don't think it's likely, but you want to say there's a non-zero chance of that happening? Sure. Mavs, Nuggets, even the Jazz. You know, I mean, they're going to have a really solid eight-man rotation. They're definitely be trying in the regular season. Blazers, I mean, we don't, like, they're always an awesome offense. If they, like, they could maybe even be, like, close to a top 10 defense this year now with some of the guys they have on the wing. Like, their front court is actually, like, really good defensively now.
Yeah, I mean, it looks much better depending on how they line up. Hopefully they don't try to play these monster huge lineups again.
Well, so the early word is that Covington and Jones. Derek Jones are going to start at the forward, which is good.
That should be good. And then, you know, because that probably pushes Collins to more minutes at backup five, bring Trenton Hood off the bench on the perimeter. You're not relying on Enes Kanter as much. You're not playing Melo as much, hopefully. And if they could find a backup point guard, which they conspicuously ignored, they could probably be really good.
Yeah. But they'll be, I mean, if they just do a three guard rotation with Trent and the two starters, I think you're probably fine there.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing, I mean, they always, less so this year, but I've always felt that Portland, it all hinges a little too much on Damian Lillard playing 82 times 40. So we'll see what that, I mean, Portland's definitely going to be good. I just have a hard time seeing them getting to a point where they're really scary.
Okay, please tell us all seven. All right, so Lakers, Clippers, Jazz, Nuggets, Mavericks, Suns, Blazers. I think there is at least a chance that any of those teams could win the most games in the Western Conference. Much lower for some than for others, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. I would say those are the seven teams where you go into the season thinking those are your probable playoff teams, and then let's throw down and see who ends up at number eight.
Well, so Kevin Pelton's projections using RPM has the Lakers as the number one seed with 44 wins, and it's got the Suns and Blazers with, you know, 39 wins. Five-win difference. Like, anything can happen to cause a five-win difference, even if it's only a 72-game season. Like,
now his...
you could just have, like, luck based on, you know, your point differential, and just winning in close games can make up a five-game difference.
Yeah, yeah. Although his projection is crazy close. I have a bigger spread than that. But yeah, I mean, these top seven in the West is going to be interesting, and then I think sort of 8-12 in the West is going to be really interesting. In terms of who gets that number eight, who gets into the play-in tournament, and who gets left out.
You know, the more I think about it, actually, I think it's like a pretty clear hierarchy. We can talk about the bottom here now, but here's who I would leave out of that. I'm going to leave out the Grizzlies, the Wolves, the Kings, the Spurs, and the Thunder. So that's five.
Okay.
So I think you've got like a pretty clear top 10 to me. And obviously injuries are going to change all that. A Harden trade could change that too.
I think Minnesota's going to be pretty decent. And I think even with the injuries, the way Memphis is set up for a compressed season when they have such a strong bench, I think they're still going to be pretty competitive.
I think their offense is just going to be terrible. Like, they're so reliant on Jackson shooting to make up for
that,
all these.
So that's the biggest thing I worry about, is that with Jaren out of the lineup at the start of the season, just are they just going to be able to score? Is there just not enough shooting out there? you know, it's going to be interesting to see how they play. Are they going to have to, you know, last year they were starting Anthony Tolliver, which was just like a cry for help, right? Just to get enough spacing out there.
Yeah.
What can they do to generate that space this year? I mean, Kyle Anderson's probably starting in Winslow's place. He's developed a little more of a three ball, but I think they still need one more shooter out there. It's almost like they may end up having to start Grayson Allen and sliding everybody up a spot just to have enough shooting on the floor to just be able to kind of operate with their starting group. But that's going to put them at a disadvantage too. So yeah, it's amazing how important Jaren is to making that thing work, at least until John Morant gets to the point where he's more comfortable as a shooter.
My boy on the left, I think that's me looking like Mark Zuckerberg. Although doesn't Mark Zuckerberg just like never move his face and never blink when he's talking? I'm like basically the opposite of that. I like get all like animated and like move my head around and stuff. So, also Mark Zuckerberg would probably have like, you know, a nicer background behind him.
there are many differences between you two that we don't need to go into.
All right. How about this one from Gruntask? With the COVID situation, could the league change the roster limit rules, say up to 20?
Probably not. I think they're fine at 17. They really softened up the two-way rules this year so that these two-way guys are going to be eligible to play in most of the games. They gave themselves enough leeway to change things on the fly, but I can't see them changing to that extent. What they can do in some cases is grant a roster exemption temporarily that allows teams to sign extra players, especially to non-guaranteed or 10-day contracts. We became very familiar with roster exemptions in Memphis in 2016 when we had three of them at the same time. I was told later by somebody at the league office that they had to create all kinds of spreadsheets and whatnot that they had never had to do before just to keep track of our situation. That's what the league does. Individual teams are granted roster exemptions if they have too many injured players at the same time. And so that would still apply, I think, in this case, if there was a rash of cases on one team.
Yeah, and also it would get to be so ugly at that point. And I think when they're not going to have fans in the stands, you know, the issue of like, oh man, if we have to cancel this game and tickets and stuff, it seems easier to just cancel it at that point.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and we'll see. I mean, how many of these teams get to 72 games will be very, very interesting. Let's see here. Yeah, another great point being made, just that COVID could, with, you know, if somebody gets COVID and they're out for 2 weeks minimum, like that could swing five games, especially with the truncated schedule this year. So let's see here. Nate, why does your chair look so big? I'm just
That's
glad
an
that
important
people are...
point that we haven't discussed.
How big my chair is?
Yes. That is a throne.
Well, I'm a big guy. But it's good to know that, you know, people are concentrating on the content of what we're saying rather than utterly superficial details.
Yeah.
So it's good to know that this is what has made us popular. Sorry, what you were going to say, a big point that hasn't been talked about enough.
Your chair was the point. But we actually have a good question here. From Carl Villages, with the Kemba news, will Boston use the traded player exception for a veteran point guard? Who could they get for not much, like a second round pick? I do think they're sitting on that $28 million exception. I think what you probably do if you're Boston, you play out 20, 30 games, see what you have, see how everything looks, see how Kemba's looking before you really go to town on using that exception. You can potentially take it into next summer, all of it, or you can use bits and pieces of it, right? You could use $5 million here, $8 million there, and still carry $15 into the summer. There's a lot of different ways they could go. I think the veteran point guard market right now is actually kind of soft. I mean, you talk about using the exception. I mean, you could like sign Shabazz Napier tomorrow. There's still halfway decent point guards that are out there if they wanted one. So interesting to see how Boston uses that giant exception, though, because I do think that is the biggest chip they have left to kind of put pieces around this Tatum Brown Smart Walker core, especially if these draft picks don't hit.
Yeah, that's a good point. And now, I mean, there have been plenty of, I think, fantasies of, oh, they'll just grab this one guy who makes $27 million. I'm not sure who that ends up being. I mean, my fantasy for them has always been Rudy Gobert. Yes. I think when they believed that they were going to have Gordon Hayward under contract at $34 million this year, that may have been a little bit more realistic. Would Gobert actually fit into that trade exception? All right, no, I'm not going down this road. I just said it was a fantasy. But yeah, and they'll probably send something back in there, but there's still the size of the trade exception matters because you have to fit that guy in there if it's an imbalanced trade. So yeah, I mean, I think we just need to see how good they are this year. Are they going to go and see where Kemba is at as well? I mean, if Kemba Walker is like, oh, he doesn't play at all this season and they got 2 more years of dead contract Kemba Walker.
Yeah.
Then maybe there's a retrenchment around Brown and Tatum, and they kind of. But if Kemba Walker comes back and he's good to go, and you could win the championship this year, that totally changes your thoughts.
Then I think you got to be all in. Yeah, yeah. Gobert does fit into the trade exception, so I'll be that guy now. Hey, you know, Semi Ojeleye for Rudy Gobert works in the trade machine.
Got a few questions about like the 2021 draft college stuff. Have you been watching anything? You got any early impressions? We can finish up with that. We got about 3 minutes left.
I've been watching a little bit, and I liked what I saw from Cade Cunningham and you know, a couple of these Gonzaga guys, but I generally don't register too much what these guys do in November. I care a lot more with the freshmen, the one and dones especially, how they progress into January, February, what they look like that second half of their freshman season. I think it's much more telling for what kind of player they're going to be. A lot of these guys aren't very good in November games, even though you can see some of the talent. Like I was watching Texas, for instance, and Greg Brown, like you could see these flashes where you're like, oh, and then you look at the end of the game, he's got like 9 points and 4 rebounds. But I'm really interested to see, like, what does that look like in November, January, February. So that to me is always when I'm looking at these one and dones, I don't really take it too seriously when I'm watching them in November.
Yeah. I mean, I generally avoid watching college until I really get into my draft prep. A couple months before the draft, and I just watch it all on tape. I mean, I saw a few highlights of Cade Cunningham, and like his jumper definitely looks pretty wet. But other than that, no real comments. Let's hit one more question here before we end up. You want to pick one?
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. You're asking if I wanted to pick one.
Yes.
Yes. Am I crazy to think, Joshua Toast, we got a Bulls question for you, Nate. Am I crazy to think the Bulls are likely a bottom four team in the NBA, or was the coaching really that bad?
You do wonder how the offense is going to get much better, you know, because I mean, people have kind of crapped on Boylan's offense. Like, I mean, they were taking the right shots. Like, I'm not sure where this low hanging fruit is to improve that much offensively. They just don't have like great primary playmakers, and they don't have a ton of shooting. If Otto Porter doesn't play this year to the extent that he didn't play last year, I think that's actually totally realistic that they could be really bad. I mean, I think Billy Donovan is competent, but I think Jim Boylan, it was more kind of from an emotional standpoint. Like, I didn't think from a scheme perspective that he was doing anything that was that bad. I think actually he probably got him to punch above their weight defensively with all the turnovers that they were forcing and being super aggressive. That doesn't work against good teams, but it worked against bad teams. So
yeah. The other thing is they got to allow Wendell Carter to shoot again.
Yeah.
So no, getting those bigs to where like Carter and Markkanen, if they can be more legitimate stretch threats, then you're talking about a more open floor for Levine and Kobe White and Levine. And then like that just feels so much more threatening. But if they're just going to be like low 30 guys from out there, then, you know, whatever. And then the other thing, I think with Patrick Williams, if he's on the Hachimura this year, that's going to drag down the offense a little, where he's, you know, where it's like 25 charity minutes a game just to develop him, you know, regardless of whether he's playing well. I think that could set back the offense, obviously, too.
Yeah, I think so, because, and it really just goes back to Kobe White, Levine, Porter's health, Markkanen, Carter, like those guys all have to take step forward. And if they can, then the Bulls will be totally respectable. But if they can't, then they're just going to be right back where they were previously.
Yeah.
And you never want to assume that there's going to be improvement necessarily.
Exactly.
Even for young players. All right, well, this was awesome. Thank you so much for all the great questions that you gave us. And a reminder, we are always here on Twitch, at least through the end of the year, 11:30 Pacific, 2:30 Eastern on Thursdays. Or you can listen, of course, to Hollinger and Duncan in any of your podcast players. Talk to y'all next week. Till then.